Hello, and welcome to 15 Minute History. This season is about villains, the signs of their rise to power, and the steps heroes take to defeat them. If this is your first time here, we're glad to have you. Stay connected with us at our website, 15minutehistorypodcast.org, for transcripts, older episodes, or to get in touch with us. We love hearing from you, so please send us questions and comments. Now, let's start the show.
Sir, your audience is ended. There is nothing I can do for you. President Andrew Jackson to a Cherokee chief, 1838.
In the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning, I saw them loaded like cattle or sheep into 645 wagons and started toward the west. One can never forget the sadness and solemnity of that morning. Chief John Ross led in prayer, and when the bugle sounded and the wagons started rolling, many of the children rose to their feet and waved their little hands goodbye to their mountain homes, knowing they were leaving them forever. Many of these helpless people did not have blankets, and many of them had been driven from their home barefooted. On the morning of November the 17th, we encountered a terrific sleet and snowstorm with freezing temperatures. And from that day until we reached the end of the faithful journey on March the 26th, 1839, the sufferings of the Cherokees were awful. The trail of the exiles was a trail of death. They had to sleep in the wagons and on the ground without fire. And I have known as many as 22 of them to die in one night of pneumonia due to ill treatment, cold, and exposure. Among this number was the beautiful Christian wife of Chief John Ross. This noble-hearted woman died a martyr to childhood, giving her only blanket for the protection of a sick child. She rode thinly clad through the blinding sleet and snowstorm, developed pneumonia, and died in the still hours of a bleak winter night, with her head resting on Lieutenant Gregg's saddle blanket. From the Journal of Private John G. Burnett, soldier in the 2nd Regiment, 2nd Brigade. Background. In the early 1800s, American expansion reached a fever pitch. Georgia, Alabama, Mississippi, and Tennessee were coveted by settlers due to their fertile lands and a gold rush that was so profitable, a single prospector could yield pounds of gold in a single day. Other factors, such as the expansion of chattel slavery and the invention of the cotton gin, fueled the expansion and made population growth within the states exponential. These developments coincided with the prevailing ideology of manifest destiny, which envisioned westward expansion of the United States as divinely ordained. Within these areas, specific Indian tribes declared territories that, over the previous 30 years, had been annexed, shrunk, and modified. Ancestral lands allocated to the different tribes were constantly being encroached upon by settlers, prospectors, and poachers, all of whom could care less about the Native American peoples, their customs, or their ownership of the land they possessed. The intruders committed these acts for a few reasons. First, Native Americans were considered savages by European settlers, and more often than not, seen as subhuman. Second, such individuals had the weight of law enforcement and the U.S. Army to back them up in the event of a skirmish. Finally, of the many treaties going on with the different tribes, the last thing many of the native peoples wanted was to provoke a conflict, which over time would inflict a larger scale response, making things inherently worse. One way to pacify American leaders and lawmakers was for the Native Americans to join the burgeoning American society. Early American leaders suggested and worked with several tribes to civilize them, and while most tribes declined these suggestions, those that did acquiesce did so in the hope that they would be left alone. Called the Five Civilized Tribes, the Cherokee, Creek, Seminole, Chickasaw, and Choctaw adopted many European customs, including agriculture and political structures, which earned them the designation civilized. Unfortunately, adopting these customs did not shield them from the government's removal policy. Assimilation and removal. Assimilation with European culture was the first step in expansion, as it was believed that Indians who adopted such customs would be easier to manage and control. The Five Civilized Tribes made many strides in these areas, but it was not enough to offset the desire for intruders to encroach upon their land. To be clear, the assimilation did not fail. According to many historians, what failed was the expectations placed upon assimilation and its outcomes. To put it simply, the government wanted more. Previous treaties were ignored or overturned, with many settlers simply invading the protective native lands for their own purposes. After many violations, this finally caused armed conflict between the settlers and many tribes, which promoted a larger government response to the growing issue. A series of moves by Congress continued to put pressure on the tribes occupying the desired lands, and in 1829, Andrew Jackson was elected President of the United States. During his term, all Indians would face the full brunt of federal oppression. Before he was president, Andrew Jackson, a Democrat, was a soldier who had served with or fought against many Indian tribes. He was known to be strong-willed, devoid of compassion or empathy, and due to these and other attributes, had a singular solution to what he deemed the Indian problem. Less than 1 year after taking office, Jackson signed the Indian Removal Act of 1830. This gave the president powers to exchange lands or move tribes out west if they so desired. What it absolutely did not do was give the president power to forcibly relocate Indian tribes against their will from their native lands to places the government saw fit to put them. This power, soon to be exercised illegally by Jackson, reflected his hatred for Native American peoples. In his first speech to Congress, Jackson said this about Indian removal. "It will separate the Indians from immediate contact with settlers of whites, free them from the power of the states, enable them to pursue happiness in their own way and under their own rude institutions. It will retard the progress of decay, which is lessening their numbers, and perhaps cause them gradually, under the protection of the government and through the influence of good counsels, to cast off their savage habits and become an interesting, civilized, and Christian community." Through the promise of, "We will exchange goods for your land and care for you," Jackson and the federal government made 86 treaties with over 26 Indian tribes, all of which eventually led to their forced removal. Many historians have noted that based on the statements and actions by Jackson, it is likely that there was never any intent to preserve or help the tribes in question. Rather, there was a desire to see them exterminated. These practices continued until the Cherokee Nation pushed against the Indian Removal Act of 1830, resulting in a challenge. The Supreme Court intervenes. In 1831, the argument for Indian sovereignty had made its way through the courts, eventually ending up at the Supreme Court. In the case Cherokee Nation versus Georgia, the court sided with Georgia and ruled that the tribe was not sovereign. As a result of this ruling, more squatters began settling on Indian lands. In addition, there were several incidents of mass murder, forced relocation by private parties, and armed conflict that resulted in more federal oversight and oppression. In response, other states besides Georgia started passing laws to limit Native American sovereignty. Then, in 1832, Samuel Worcester and other settlers were arrested and put in jail for residing on Indian land without a license. Worcester appealed the decision, which made its way back to the Supreme Court. In this case, he declared that previous treaties declared Indian sovereignty and made them nations under which the laws of Georgia had no force. This time, the Supreme Court ruled in favor of Indian sovereignty. This was a landmark decision, as it affirmed the sovereignty of the Indian tribes, and that while the federal government had the right to negotiate with these tribes, it did not have the right to forcibly take their land, affect their laws, or designate them as anything but a sovereign nation. After the ruling, one of the justices, Joseph Story, wrote in a letter to his wife, "Thanks be to God, the court can wash their hands clean of the iniquity of oppressing the Indians and disregarding their rights." This should have halted all actions against Indian tribes allowed by the Indian Removal Act of 1830. However, as expressed in other podcasts, the power of the Supreme Court extends to the interpretation of law and the Constitution, and not to the enforcement of any ruling. Due to this lack of enforcement, Andrew Jackson declared the ruling stillborn and proceeded with his plans as if the case had never happened. The Trail. What resulted was the forced removal and march of tens of thousands of Native Americans from their lands to what was classified as Indian territory. This journey was hundreds of miles, had little support, food, water, or medical care for the tribes being relocated. The federal government and U.S. Army were not equipped, nor did they have the experience for, moving said peoples en masse across the country. The march was so horrendous and the death toll so high that many historians believe it was made to be intentionally brutal by the administration and others in government. It is impossible for me to summarize the anguish secondhand. So in light of having a primary source to draw from, I've included more excerpts from the journal of Private John G. Burnett, who helped with the migration. The removal of Cherokee Indians from their lifelong homes in the year of 1838 found me a young man in the prime of life and a private soldier in the American Army. Being acquainted with many of the Indians and able to fluently speak their language, I was sent as an interpreter into the Smoky Mountain country in May 1838 and witnessed the execution of the most brutal order in the history of American warfare. I saw the helpless Cherokees arrested and dragged from their homes and driven at bayonet point into the stockades. And in the chill of a drizzling rain on an October morning, I saw them loaded like cattle or sheep into 645 wagons and started toward the west. I made the long journey to the west with the Cherokees and did all that a private soldier could do to alleviate their sufferings. When on guard duty at night, I at many times walked my beat in my blouse in order that some sick child might have the warmth of my overcoat. The long, painful journey to the west ended March 26, 1839, with 4,000 silent graves reaching from the foothills of the Smoky Mountains to what is known as Indian Territory in the west. The covetousness on the part of the white race was the cause of all that the Cherokees had to suffer. In the year 1828, a little Indian boy living on Ward Creek had sold a gold ingot to a white trader, and that ingot sealed the doom of the Cherokees. In a short time, the country was overrun with armed brigades claiming to be government agents who paid no attention to the rights of Indians who were the legal possessors of the country. Crimes were committed that were a disgrace to the civilization. Men were shot in cold blood. Lands were confiscated, and homes were burned and the inhabitants driven out by gold-hungry brigands. Chief Junaluska was personally acquainted with President Andrew Jackson. Junaluska had taken 500 of the flower of his Cherokee scouts and helped Jackson to win the Battle of the Horseshoe, leaving 33 of them dead on the field. And in that battle, Junaluska had drove his tomahawk through the skull of a Creek warrior when the Creek had Jackson at his mercy. Chief John Ross sent Junaluska as an envoy to plead with President Jackson for protection for his people, but Jackson's manner was cold and indifferent toward the rugged son of the forest who had saved his life. He met Junaluska, heard his plea, but curtly said, "Sir, your audience is ended. There is nothing I can do for you." The doom of the Cherokee was sealed. Washington, D.C. had declared that they must be driven west and their lands given to the white man. And in May 1838, an army of 4,000 regulars and 3,000 volunteer soldiers under the command of General Winfield Scott marched into the Indian country and wrote the blackest chapter on the pages of American history. I can truthfully say that I did my best for them when they certainly did need a friend. 25 years after the removal, I still lived in their memory as the soldier that was good to us. However, murder is murder. Whether committed by the villain skulking in the dark, uniformed men stepping to the strains of martial music. Murder is murder, and someone must answer. Someone must explain the streams of blood that flowed in the Indian country in the summer of 1838. Somebody must explain the 4,000 silent graves that marked the trail of the Cherokees to their exile. I wish I could forget it all, but the picture of 645 wagons lumbering over the frozen ground with their cargo of suffering humanity still lingers in my memory. Let the historian of a future day tell the sad story and its sighs, its tears and dying groans. Let the judge of all the earth weigh our actions and reward us according to our work. Being honest about evil. Dear audience, even with the primary source material and attention to this event, I have failed in sharing with you the absolute horror endured by Native peoples at the hands of the U.S. government. The Trail of Tears is a dark stain on American history, a brutal episode of forced relocation that displaced Native American tribes from their ancestral homes. A few weeks ago, John spoke to the actions of government being likened to a hammer. Here, in the pages of history, we see the effects. As we look back, it is also important to know that not all settlers were part of the problem. In fact, history shows that many stood up for the native peoples, for their rights, and for their land. This, coupled with the fact that the Supreme Court ruled in their favor, shows some measure of the intended checks and balances to protect the rights of individuals, even if the ruling parties are anything but impartial. The actions of Andrew Jackson show the other dark side. The actions of one man, supported by the bigotry and arrogance in all branches of government, counteracted those checks and balances, simply because no one had the courage or desire to put a stop to it. On August 12, 1986, President Ronald Reagan said in a speech that the nine most terrifying words in the English language are, "I'm from the government and I'm here to help." Of the many instances where such a quote was made manifest in our history, the Trail of Tears stands out. It represents a profound loss of life, land, and cultural heritage for the Native American tribes. It stands as a stark reminder of the often violent consequences of the federal hammer, and that even in light of the checks on power, lawmakers and citizens have an obligation to stand and say no. Thank you for joining us on 15 Minute History. Please take a moment to send us any questions about this topic and leave a review wherever you listen to this podcast. It really does help. You can also partner with us by going to our website, clicking the support button, and donating now. We hope you will keep joining us this season as we walk in history's footsteps, 15 minutes at a time.